great pleasure to be here. Thanks to Paul for inviting me. And it's lovely to meet old friends again. The last time I was here, I met Madeline Darcy, and I was here on the invitation from Patrick Cotter, and really am appreciative of all that. So I was thinking of Nuala O'Fallon. I met her at the Ennis Book Festival one year, and it was actually the year she was diagnosed with terminal illness. And there was a poet about to read before Nuala got up to speak, and he said something to the effect of, "How long should I read for?" And she said, "Not too long," you know, which I suppose she was throwing caution to the wind at the time, and you know, something you wouldn't generally say to a poet, "Not too long." So it's something that I'm very wary of myself. I'd rather be blessed than cursed. And I'm very aware that my tights are laddered and I'm loose threads everywhere. But I'm hoping that you'll enjoy my poetry. And I have it under my oxter here. So I'm going to start with the last poem that I've had published, which was a festive visit after a visit to Patrick Kavanagh's graveside in Inneskeen. And it was published by Pig House Press in Brighton. It feels good to leave such idle fireside chatter, subtleties of sauce, tastings of meat that hung 3 days on an outhouse door, to see sky hurrying above, us rosy from weather, the wren hunted and buried, everything said that could be said, that man from the town who wrung our turkey's bobbling neck, its wishing bone came to me, having more than a shade of a neighbour we once knew, who threw down his letters from England unread, if no money fluttered from the envelope. Stirring such embers brought our own father, who delivered those long ago letters. Kavanagh too flared briefly, reading newspapers on the steps of Jones's butchers, finishing a page before consigning it to the gutter. Everything that could be said was said. Inneskeen susceptibility to cyclones, an earthquake alert every 50 years or so. Enough time since the poet's passing to set us counting on a day when the year is turning like a fresh sod. We plant our feet into damp December soil, each of us huddling into our own small commotions, longing perhaps for quakes or wanting back familiar rituals that shake the clay off the hours. And the next one was written when I was in Lexington, Kentucky, and I really enjoyed my visit there. I used to go to Starbucks coffee first thing in the morning. I'm an early riser. I rise ridiculously early, 6 a.m. and I found myself in Starbucks most morning and listening to people talking about horses and business studs. Well, let's not mince our words here. So I found that very exhilarating, and also my husband ringing me then before he went to work at 8:30 in the morning. So all of that is in this poem. Astronomer on the 15th floor. By the way, I stayed in the Hilton in Lexington, which was very extravagant and very luxurious. It was lovely, and no more than I deserved, let me tell you. To the left, the highest building with its fiery eyebrow raised above grounded stars, tail-like constellations, cars and trucks mapping concrete paths. Blue light switches on below my heart, shadowing my lover's face across a galaxy of cloud and sea. Then I remember, already half a day ahead, lunchtime sandwiches eaten, winter grimes his skin as he climbs telegraph poles or burrows beneath pale earth, mending wires, weather-broken communication. street lamps are globes, burgeoning a pawn shop's three moons, morning still in hock to a January sky. Breath steams from the mouths of pedestrians headed towards Starbucks on the corner, where I too will soon be sipping coffee, straining to hear what it is people talk about in a strange city at 8 a.m. Yesterday, a woman asked me my whereabouts, where I got my coat, so pretty, honey, like my Irish accent. Two men in business suits named a foal whose hooves someday will beat like pulsars on a paddock out in Kingland, where grasses mauve toward spring and dog roses not yet bloomed are tracked by cardinals red as Mars. And I should have said my husband works in aircom, so that accounts for the weather broken communication, which didn't happen to us. I'd like to read actually a love poem from my husband, who has been a tremendous source of help for me throughout the years, and had four children and three grandchildren, and I don't think I would have been able to write or give all of the time that I have given to writing, which over 30 years now has been quite a considerable amount. And I know when we first got married, I thought more of my writing than I did of the bedroom. So he did kind of help me a lot and was very understanding. We also light fires every day, winter and summer, in our fireplace. And twice a year, we clean the chimney. So this poem was written after a thorough cleaning of the chimney, and it's called Soot. We should be drinking tea, reading newspapers, shuffling our daughters from their beds. Instead, masked and gloved, our furniture shrouded in dust sheets, glass and mirrors covered, our Sunday morning transforms to morning room. My role is this: deliver on cue each spiky rod, keep down the mess, as all good wives should. You, my husband of so many winters past, disappear to shoulder line up the tunnelling gateway. Such caution, Haydays himself might pull you up. But you come back again. Even Elysian fields could not tempt you from me now. None the worse, except for charcoal speckles in your greying hair, brimming shades of how it used to be. Each time the rod goes up, you give an extra heave, Sisyphus rolling the stone so steep this chimney climbing. Smells of smoke bring fires we burned into lengthening evenings. The rods too grow longer, divining their way to the top, shooting out like a hornbeam's domed crown. How many times you might, I wonder, have cheated death, slipped away in sleep, as the sun too, swerving on midnight bends, goes down, rises again. This last push sheens your forehead. You are no longer the boy in bare feet at Muckle's shore, pulling on the tug of war rope in another life. A blizzard of soot floods our grate, abundant sands like seeds carried by birds grow the toughest timber. Above our masks spies meet, such pleased surprise we see, as when our firstborn came shooting down the birth canal, or, having flocked in rhythmic patterns, we settle again on roosting branches, shake our feathers clean. I'm going to go to my Daybook collection. They call it a Daybook collection, but really you've done every round under the sun before your Daybook collection comes out, and you've had publications here and there, so it's not really a it's not really anything new when the Day Boo collection comes out. I think those of you who have been published already will agree with me there. So I'm going to indulge myself, I suppose, and read the poem that really started me writing in the first place and came from a very deep place. It's called First Love. To lift that latch was like pulling back a trigger. Breath held, downslide of steel eased into clips of rain on galvanized roofs, sucks of wind bloating mother's sheets. Father's jacket nest warm hung on an outhouse door, a crumple of plaid patterned wool. I felt for shape, found slim white smoky fingers swaddled by silver slips. A captain sea knotted my stomach. Players, please, captioned under his smile. His sea blue eyes were deep as the distance father kept from me, his youngest, snail trailing across afternoons he slept before the night shift. I shook like the thin white bones rattling inside his box of matches, struck in shadowed hollows of hands cupped around pink-lipped flames and whiskey. I lit that flicker, took the powdery taste of him deep into my throat, dizzy with love. I do come from the Midlands, and a lot of my earlier poems were written about growing up there and the characters I met. But tantalisingly now, I'm not going to read a Midland poem. I'm going to read a poem called Kestrel at Tymon Park. I live in Talla, South County Dublin, and it's a very built-up area, as you can imagine. It has changed enormously over the years that I've lived there. I've seen apartment blocks spring up like totems all over the landscape. But luckily enough, we still have kestrels coming to our local park, and this is where this poem came from. This bird, though small, her wimpling wings would scarce fill my outstretched hand from fingertip to wrist, is large enough to be the female of her breed. Firing powerful engines that breathe like mysteries through the rise and fall of centuries. Empress of the skies, her pin eye is trained on bustling grasses, alive with insects fattening her breast, attracting the mate who must surely clade with her here, on this green heath, find his own hovering height, over a lake succulent with frog, blue damsel fly. She is no fool. Her beak was blooded in places such as this. While sleeping earth was forced to yield, she soared, oblivious to decades of change, traffic snarling past these iron gates. Her eye can penetrate densest marl, the way filtering light through thinning branches, sycamore, alder, beech, lures down to brute earth, skin on skin, sense of hurried love faltering into history. This is not her story. She bides her time, can live in nests vacated by other birds. She can rise high as 60 feet, far higher than anything else stroking Talla landscape, high over streams of creed and colour, unspooled across Sunday walkways, skimming coppiced woodlands, heavy hedgerows, feasts of elderberries, fruits she has no taste for. Up she soars, taking me with her, up, up, until I can go no further, falling back on the words of a poem that fly into my mouth from an old forgotten place. She grows smaller, becomes a speck to my human eye, but my heart swells is stirred by such a bird as she. Oh, the achieve of the mastery of the thing. And the next poem from Drinking the Colour Blue, it's about my father, and I suppose we have uneasy relationships with our parents, which we often don't admit to, but I think it's where good writing will come from as well. So this one is called The Man with Sides for Arms. He swishes through the kitchen, black dark outside, midnight in the cupboards. Who knows what's in his head, what shape or sense he sees around the chairs, cushions plump as the breasts of the woman he is harnessed to, her belly protruding under him. He rides the night ride up these stairs, awkward like a colt trying to stand. There he lies until the woman on his back, the woman who looks as if she has just plopped out of a large pink jelly mold, pulls away from him. Joined at the hip for now by his dead-end job, her lack of somewhere else to go. What he sees in the morning as he sways tall, hollyhock tall, hairy, forgotten to shave, what he sees is the swell of his brood squeezed into corners. His swishing cannot reach, though today his blades are blunt, and the grass, though overgrown, holds no threat for now. I'm very mindful that I should read something connected to the Lost and Found workshop that I held earlier this evening, and which I hope everybody enjoyed. And now, of course, I won't be able to find it. Oh, here it is. The gods are with me. But I was explaining that I bought these commemorative issues of the New York Times while I was passing through an airport. I was very lucky to get it. And I was trawling through 1901 issue when I found interesting little tidbits. And then I imagined the sinking of Titanic. I think it was 9 years later or 10 years later. So anyway, the poem should be self-explanatory. It's called Passengers. It's 1901. The New York Times reports an auction upcoming in Cincinnati. Three corsets, abandoned goods, housed in the basement of government buildings, are offered in the sale. Made in Paris, France, ex-property of the Duchess of Manchester, who refused to pay the duty owed. Perhaps the cost is reckoned high for such fripperies, though much is made of tint and texture, a particular style named Dreams of Delight, patterned in the embroidery. On the same page, sunk below this item, news of Clarence Coles, a blackboard manufacturer, burned to death, delirious, suffering from pneumonia in his boarding house on 47 Point Street, Brooklyn. Coles rose from his bed in the back parlour, struck a light, and in some peculiar way the furniture caught fire, a conflagration lasting a good quarter hour before discovery. Panicked, other occupants fled the house, forgetting about a man whose very name was not without some irony. In an even shorter space reads a violent crime, Minnie Crawley, shot and killed at age 16 by Antonio Friuli. The rejected suitor took her life at Mulberry and Bayard Street, midnight on the 4th of March in the same year. A decade or so later, passengers are listed from Titanic. No mention here of a certain duchess. The price for passage far greater than the $12 left outstanding on the corsets. A paltry sum when pitched against the cost of a first-class ticket. Parsimony may perhaps have spared her life. when rivets laced in steel became inexorably undone. Three corsets are burning in a boarding house, blazing briefly like a flare in an ink-black sky. The untimely death of one so young. Which of these warrant sequel or revision? Had Cole survived and Crawl and not been murdered, who knows where time and tide might place them, whether on welcoming pier or upper deck, when the most splendid ship ever to leave Belfast full steamed onto the high seas of their own dreaming delights. And I think I'll finish now on a final poem. And this poem is called From the Royal School. I stayed in Armagh in the Royal School for the John Hewitt Festival about, I think it was 2 years ago. And before I went to the Royal School, I visited the exhibition of King Tutankhamun. And I never thought I'd get the connections that I did, but they were quite uncanny. So, from the Royal School. It's now a week since I saw the boy King Tutankhamun put on show in Dublin. Taken from his resting place inside three coffins, which in turn were housed in four containers, leafed in golden hieroglyphics, replicas all, as if the past might be constructed from old photographs and settled under glass, left in total darkness, absolute stillness, until layers unpeel beyond a golden mask. Under that again, wrapped in linen shrouds, eyes, ears, nose and mouth. Here in Armagh, I'm bound to be reminded, and by the smallest thing no less, a clump of petals withering on the path outside this door, fallen out of bouquet or hanging basket, like a yellow chick from its nest. Who cares or who can tell? Yet bringing me love notes all the same, strewn by a child bride before the lid was closed. In the Royal School, that first night's sleep tears on the briars of finding peace in a strange place. Still, I wake to Harold's Cross, hear traffic rumbling by, headed towards the city of my 18th year. A narrow single bed takes me to the present tense, reaching for ghost warmth, my husband sleeping back. This small window tells me how little, or indeed how much, I piece together that makes sense. A town is a town is a town is a town. I can pull my blind up or roll it down. From these remnants I sow curving pathways flanked by green, a wild bird, mysterious ibis, or just a solitary crow pecking for an early worm as my pen pecks at blank pages. That bird is usurped at evening by pigeons roosting in McGarry's shed in the Midlands where I come from, forcing out such guttural sounds. Across tracts of green and thyme, houses lean together, gossiping in mime. Beyond those houses a rush of angles, streets shielding each other from full view and scarce a glimpse of moon. Muscles in my thighs feel the steep rise to Market Square, Armagh Cathedral, bearings taken from the laundrette at its gate, boasting squeaky clean while collapsing into ruin. My windowsill is wide enough to sit upon. If Lancelot comes, I will gladly gaze upon his trace. For I've not seen one living soul pass beneath these panes, only swallows gorging on the wing for flying south. The Royal School seals me in, swaddles of stairwells, each one leads to another story. Across the mall are names inscribed in stone, names I knew the childhood taste of: Smith, Durkin, Talbot, Delaney, Walsh, Daly, Boyce, Wilson, McNally, McCarthy, and O'Neill. These voices silence now this monument of meeting place. Young men and women stake their claims to life and love, while children play on the cannon as if it were an iron horse, riding out at noon or grazing, staying put. It's that time of year too, end of summer, bricking itself up. Dresses in the shops touched by strangers are marked down, soon to be covered in polythene, put in storage. I half expect to see my mother in Armagh. These streets appear to be the same as home. A town is a town, is a town is a town. Or a neighbour long since dead, Sarah Purcell, her blue-black hair, the one luminous thing, glinting under sunlight. A woman whose sleeves rolled to the elbow, who kept her legs, arms and head bare, breathing every bit of air. Her house was the last one on our road to be connected, electricity flooding into places used to flickering shadows, unsettling her for days, breaking up her words in strangest ways. Thank you very much.